Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They have certain requirements in the law that have to be met, and if they're not meeting those requirements, they certainly can face fines from us, and they can face legal action from homeowners.
The Obama administration says it will hold banks accountable for foreclosure fraud, but is not supporting a foreclosure moratorium. Meanwhile, protests against austerity measures and budget cuts grip Europe. We'll be joined by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, author of Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. Then, Tea Party nationalism. The NAACP releases a report exposing what it calls links between various Tea Party organizations and racist hate groups in the United States. We'll speak with the president of the NAACP, Ben Jealous. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon says it suspended enforcement of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law barring openly gay men and women from the armed forces. On Tuesday, military officials said recruitment offices have been instructed to accept openly gay and lesbian applicants in accordance with a federal court injunction issued last week. But recruiters have also been told to advise applicants the ban may be reimposed pending a Justice Department appeal. The Obama administration sought to reinstate the ban to allow the Pentagon to conclude an internal review. The Service Members Legal Defense Network says it's advised gay men and lesbians not to apply for the armed forces because of the legal uncertainty. Here in New York, one of the most vocal critics of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Lieutenant Dan Choi, filed papers to reenlist in the military after being discharged earlier this year. Standing outside the recruitment station in Times Square, Choi criticized President Obama for challenging the court's repeal.
Well, it's very difficult for us to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell if President Obama continues to do nothing but say some words. Some people make their statements based on words. I make my statement based on service and action. And I hope that President Obama can do the same thing. When I think of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I realize that the victims are not just the gay people who have been kicked out. 14,000 is quite a bit of victims, but I've never claimed victimhood. The victims in Don't Ask, Don't Tell are those units that are stripped of the talented and capable team members, family members. And we do them a disservice. We do the entire military a disservice when we discriminate against one kind of people.
Federal investigators have opened a criminal probe of the improper approval of thousands of foreclosures by some of the nation's largest banks. The Financial Fraud Enforcement Task Force says it's conducting a multi-agency investigation of allegations lenders filed fraudulent documents to repossess homes. The firms are being investigated for allegedly misleading federal housing agencies and for potential violations of federal laws on mail or wire fraud. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said banks could face legal action.
They have certain requirements under the law that have to be met, and if they're not meeting those requirements, they certainly can face fines from us, and they can face legal action from homeowners.
The probe comes as the sheriff for Cook County, Illinois, has announced he won't enforce foreclosure evictions for three large banks caught up in the scandal. On Tuesday, Sheriff Thomas Dart said he won't carry out evictions in Chicago and surrounding areas for Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Ally Financial's GMAC Mortgage. Bank of America and GMAC resume foreclosures this week after a brief suspension. Dart says he won't evict homeowners until the banks can prove the foreclosures are lawful. The CIA has disclosed it failed to properly vet a Jordanian double agent before he carried out a suicide bombing at a CIA base in Afghanistan last year. The attack by Humam Khalil al-Balawi killed seven CIA agents and contractors, the worst for the agency since the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon. An internal probe found that a CIA officer in Jordan failed to report warnings that Balawi may have been working for al-Qaeda. Balawi was allowed access to the CIA base after claiming he had information on the whereabouts of al-Qaeda deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri. New details have emerged on the Obama administration's backing of peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. The New York Times reports U.S.-led forces have allowed senior Taliban leaders to enter Afghanistan for meetings with Afghan leaders in Kabul. The talks have included leaders of three key factions, including the Quetta Shura, which oversees the Taliban's armed operations in Afghanistan. In at least one case, Taliban leaders flew into Kabul aboard a NATO aircraft. A U.S. soldier has been detained in Afghanistan following the shooting death of an Afghan prisoner. Afghan officials have identified the prisoner as Taliban commander Mullah Mohibullah and say he was shot dead after U.S.-led NATO troops entered the prison where he was being held. In Iraq, a convoy carrying U.N. Special Envoy Ad Melkert was attacked Tuesday in the city of Najaf. Melkert was unhurt in the incident. Earlier, he met with the Shia cleric Ali al-Sistani as part of a push for Iraq to form a coalition government.
It is now high time that parties are ready to meet. And that they are ready to do so around one table.
وأن تقوم بهذا اللقاء على طاولة واحدة.
On the basis of the principles embodied in the Constitution.
استنادا إلى المبادئ الواردة في الدستور العراقي.
And without any preconditions.
The Iranian government says it'll try the two jailed Americans, Shane Bauer and Josh Fatale, early next month. Bauer and Fatale were arrested in July of 2009 after hiking near the Iran-Iraq border. The third hiker, Sarah Shourd, was freed last month. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton renewed calls for the pair's release.
We continue to express our hope that the Iranian authorities will exercise the humanitarian option of releasing these two young men. We do not believe there is any basis whatsoever for them to be put on trial. And we regret that they and their families are being subjected to a criminal system that we do not think in any way reflects their actions.
You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see our interview with Sarah Shourd, the third hiker, her description of what the prison was like and her attempts to have her fiancé, Shane Bauer, and friend Josh Fatale freed. Britain is unveiling an austerity plan today, including its largest public sector cuts since the Second World War. Over $128 billion in government spending will be slashed, along with at least 500,000 jobs. On the eve of the announcement, British unions held a large rally in central London. The head of Britain's Trades Union Congress, Brendan Barber, denounced the cuts.
These cuts will lose over a million jobs. And let's be clear. This is not an economic necessity, but a political choice that they're making.
In campaign news back in the United States, Republican Senate hopeful Christine O'Donnell has ignited a new controversy after claiming the Constitution doesn't require a separation of church and state. O'Donnell made the comment during a debate with Democratic rival Chris Coons after Coons said he opposes teaching creationism in public schools.
Where in the Constitution is separation of church and state? Let me just clarify.
Please.
You're telling me that the separation of church and state is found in the First Amendment.
Government shall make no establishment of religion.
That's in the First Amendment.
All right, 8:15 here on 11:50 a.m.
That was the senatorial debate in Delaware. A new investigation has found over 17,000 doctors nationwide have received payments from seven major pharmaceutical companies to promote their products. According to ProPublica and several other media outlets, the number includes more than 380 doctors and other healthcare professionals who took in over $100,000 this year and in 2009. The actual number is believed to be far higher because over 70 other drug companies haven't disclosed their payments to doctors. and the Obama administration's announced plans to spend up to $760 million to compensate Native American farmers for long-term discrimination in receiving government loans. The settlement comes in the Keep Siegel case, which accused the Agricultural Department of denying thousands of loans to Native Americans while approving loans for white farmers and ranchers between 1981 and 1999. A similar settlement was reached for African-American farmers earlier this year, but Republicans have blocked the funds. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal law enforcement officials are launching an investigation into possible criminal violations of U.S. law by banks and other financial firms involved in the foreclosure crisis. The Multi-Agency Task Force on Financial Fraud, led by investigators in the Justice, Treasury, and Housing Departments, are exploring whether banks broke the law and misled federal agencies when using fraudulent documents to foreclose people's homes. The federal probe coincides with an effort by investors to hold firms accountable for selling securities composed of improperly serviced mortgages. Late Tuesday, a consortium of eight investors, including the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, demanded that Bank of America buy back some $47 billion worth of troubled home loans packaged into bonds by Countrywide Financial, which is owned by Bank of America. The New York Fed is also considering suing Bank of America. The interagency federal investigation was announced a day after Bank of America and GMAC Mortgage said they're resuming foreclosures in the 23 states where a court's approval is needed to foreclose. 10 days ago, Bank of America had imposed a nationwide halt on foreclosures following revelations employees at several lenders had approved thousands of foreclosure affidavits and other documents without proper vetting. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said the Obama administration's committed to holding banks accountable for any legal violations tied to foreclosures.
Our concern has been ensuring that the process adequately complies with the law. That's what led, like I said, that's what led FHA to get involved in this. That's what's led the Financial Fraud Enforcement Task Force to be involved in this process, as well as our support for 50 state attorneys general ensuring, again, compliance with the law. Obviously, they have certain requirements under the law that have to be met, and if they're not meeting those requirements, they certainly can face fines from us and they can face legal action from homeowners.
Well, members of President Obama's Financial Fraud Enforcement Task Force and other administration officials are scheduled to meet today to discuss the foreclosure crisis. For more on the state of the economy in this country and around the world, I'm joined here in New York by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He's a professor at Columbia University and the author, most recently, of Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. It's just out in paperback. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Nice to be here.
Okay, let's start with foreclosures. What do you think needs to be done? If you were in that room today in Washington, D.C., what would you say?
Well, first, I begin with the problem of so many Americans owing more in their homes than the value of their homes. We have to put this in context. The mortgage companies, the banks, engaged in predatory lending practices. They weren't asking what was the best mortgage for these homeowners. They were asking what was the mortgage that generated most fees for me. The way the mortgage system worked, they could take bad mortgages, sell them off to investment banks that repackage them and sell them on to other people. That's the other part of the story that you were talking about, where PIMCO, Federal Reserve, all these people who wound up with these securities say, you gave us a lot of junk. So it's all the way along the pipeline that there has been fraudulent behavior, all the way from the foreclosures that you were talking about, but really going back to the creation. So in my mind, what we should begin is trying to protect Americans. So we ought to have a homeowner's Chapter 11. Let me explain what that idea is. You know, when corporations have trouble paying what they have to pay, what we say is we can write down the debt. It's so important to keep those enterprises going, keep the jobs, keep the suppliers going, that we allow them to write down the debt and restructure. Well, keeping American families going is even more important, I think, than keeping corporations going. So that should be part of the philosophy, that we ought to say, look, at the banks were really derelict in the loans that they made. They should have known that there was a bubble going on. I certainly talked about it. Other people talked about it. They were really engaged in predation. So let's use a homeowner's Chapter 11 that allows a speedy write-down of what is owed, converting some of the debt into equity so that when they sell the loans, sometime when they repay, sell their house sometime in the future, if the market recovers, some of the capital gain will go to the bank. But meanwhile, the payments that the homeowners will have to make will go way down, and that will mean that they can stay in their home. And that'll be good for the families. It'll be good for the communities. When people are thrown out of their homes, it's bad for the family. It's bad for the community. And we have this, you know, real evidence that our market system isn't working when we have empty homes and homeless people. That's not the way a market economy is supposed to operate.
Would you support a foreclosure moratorium?
Well, I think probably the answer is yes. The fact is that they've generated so many bad mortgages, so many fraudulent mortgages. And by the way, this problem of fraud has been known for a long time. The FBI started reporting on this years ago. I talk about that problem in my book. It's not just risky lending. It was fraudulent, predatory, all of these. And so we have a backlog now, and we shouldn't be surprised that our legal system is not capable of processing the numbers of foreclosures that have to be processed. We're talking about probably something in the order of magnitude of 3 million, 3.5 million foreclosures, actions this year. Last year, the estimate was about 2 million lost their home. The year before, 2 million. Our system isn't geared to that. But there's a more, there's a deeper point that I like to raise, which is the following. You know, in a democracy like ours, people have to have confidence in the fairness of our legal system. And if they feel that the legal system is stacked against them, then voluntary compliance, our whole social fabric starts fraying. And I think a lot of Americans have come to the view that the system is stacked against them. It began in a way with the bankruptcy law that was passed back in 2005 that, in effect, reintroduced bondage in America. I mean, people haven't realized how bad that law was. If you owe 100%, you know, amount of money that's equal to 100% of your income, you have a $40,000 income, you wound up with a credit card debt, another debt of $40,000. For the rest of your life, you may be working 25% of your time for the banks. The way it works is very simple. They can take 25% of your income. You know, it used to be easy that you could go bankruptcy and you got discharged of the debt. They made it very difficult. So you can pay 25% of your income every year to the bank, but then the bank can charge you 30% interest. So at the end of the year, you owe more money than you did at the beginning of the year, even though you gave 25% of your income to the bank. Now, this is an example of something that is clearly socially unjust.
This was passed when the Republicans were in
That's
control.
Right.
And this was 2005.
That's
now,
right.
We're talking about foreclosures by banks, and which President Obama is not for a nationwide foreclosure moratorium. But even the government, it is the largest foreclosure entity out there, according to Bruce Marks of NACA, a housing activist. FHA mortgages, government-owned, are doing massive numbers of foreclosures. Fannie Mae, massive numbers of foreclosures, he said. So he said President Obama maybe doesn't want to do a full moratorium, but why not make the government-owned entities, the ones that the taxpayers own and control, let's start with them.
It actually makes sense for our economy. And let me explain why that is. Because when you dump all these mortgages, these houses, onto the market, it depresses the prices. And that means that the real estate market is destabilized. one of the advantages that the government has is that it can and should take a longer-term horizon. It should realize that if it holds on to these a little longer, provided it can maintain those homes, then it's a lot better as an owner of the home. They don't have to be short-sighted in the way the banks are so short-sighted. So in a sense, it's even good economics for the taxpayer. And again, it goes back to the point I made before. It makes absolutely no sense in our economy to be creating homeless people, throwing people out of their homes, disrupting the education of their children, undermining the communities, and at the same time having these empty homes. And what really happens when you throw people out, very quickly the house tax starts to get wasted.
And this, of course, affects these midterm elections. If President Obama cares about Democrats controlling the House and the Senate, this is the major issue, is the economy, jobs, foreclosures. And yet they constantly, just in the last few days, David Axelrod, the White House advisor speaking for the president, says they're in fact valid foreclosures that probably should go forward. HUD, they're saying the same thing. Where do people gain any confidence that the president, who said he was taking on the big corporations, cares more about them than the banks?
Well, you know, one of the key words here that you said is valid foreclosures, because we believe we have a system of the rule of law. But what we have to recognize is that there was fraud all along the line. They were creating these mortgages at such a rate that the documentation wasn't done well. That we know there are lots of instances where when the people went into the final signing of the mortgages, the income that was stated was not the income that the person told them. And then they would say something, oh, don't worry, that's a technical detail. So is that a valid mortgage or not? The fact was, it looks like the documentation was right, but in the creation of the documentation, there was fraud. Now, we were manufacturing, or the financial sector was manufacturing, bad mortgages at such a rate that literally it's extraordinarily difficult to tell at this juncture what is a good mortgage and what was not. When there was misrepresentation to the borrower, is that valid or not? And so I think we have to recognize that this process from 2003-04 on was just rife with these problems. And it allowed the banks to book high profits then. And now the key issue is they don't want to admit the losses that are associated. And that's really what the battle is about.
We're talking to Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor at Columbia University. His book is just out in paperback. It's called Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. If you want to join into the discussion, you can send in your questions at Facebook, facebook.com/democracynow. We'll be back in a minute. Nothing from nothing. Billy Preston here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 900 stations on Pacifica and NPR and college and community stations, public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, DirecTV, Channel 375, and 348. And we are—our headlines are also available in Spanish for radio stations to take us over 250 R. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor at Columbia University. His book is out in paperback, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. So just to summarize, you are for a national moratorium on foreclosures.
I think inevitably—I think we have to be moving towards that. And the reason is very simple. There were such bad practices were so rife, the inequities were so rife, the fraudulent behavior was so common that at this point we don't know what is a valid mortgage and not. And the consequences of throwing somebody out of their home when they shouldn't be, are hard to reverse. I mean, just imagine what it does to the family. The education of their kids are interrupted, what it does to the community. So when we have to balance the injustices, and life is unfortunately always balancing one side versus the other, and where will their mistakes be easily reversed and where not? My view is if we keep them in the homes for a little longer. They owe the money. They still owe the money. That doesn't let them off the hook. But what we're saying is we're not going to speed up this process of where there's a serious risk of an inequity that will not be easily compensated for.
Joe Stiglitz, the deficit, the battle cry of the Tea Party movement, of the Republicans as well. Robert Rubin has weighed in, says any new stimulus plan is highly likely to be counterproductive. What do you think has to happen? Does the deficit matter, and how do you think it should be dealt with?
My view is we cannot afford not to stimulate the economy. So, anybody that says we should go back to austerity or we should not have a second-round stimulus just doesn't understand economics. And let me be very clear about this. If we don't stimulate the economy is going to get weaker. When the economy gets weaker, tax revenues go down and expenditures go up. Already, more than 40 million Americans are on food stamps. Number of people on Medicaid is reaching record levels. So revenues go down, expenditures go up, deficits get worse. If you stimulate the economy, then people get jobs, they spend money, revenue, tax revenues go up. Now, if we spend the money on investments, investments in education, technology, infrastructure, you grow the economy in the short run from the stimulus, you grow the economy in the long term because of the returns that you get on these investments. I mean, just think about this as from the point of view of a firm. If you were a firm and you could borrow at 0 to 2.5%, which is what the government can borrow, and you have investment opportunities that yield 10, 15, 20%, you would be irresponsible. You would be foolish not to undertake those investments. So anybody that says, I'm going to only look at one side of the balance sheet, the liabilities, I'm not going to look at the other side, the assets, is really not understanding economics. It's that kind of reasoning that got our country in the trouble in the first place. The people who didn't, short-sighted behavior of the banks that got our country in trouble in the first place. And to me, I just view those kinds of statements as totally irresponsible.
Let me ask you how war fits into this. I mean, you co-wrote the book with Linda Bilmes, The $3 Trillion War. How does war fit into our problems with the economy?
Well, war fits in because you're creating a liability. You're spending money. And when we went to a war in Iraq and Afghanistan, we already had a deficit. And so these wars were the first wars in America's history financed totally on the credit card. So you're creating a liability, but you're not creating an asset. So that's the kind of spending that does weaken the economy because it's one-sided. Now, We came out just a couple weeks ago with new numbers that unfortunately show that our old numbers were a little wrong in the sense that they were too conservative.
$3 trillion.
Was too little. And particularly what we looked at in a report we testified before Congress, what we looked at was the large number of troops returning who are disabled. Turned out that the numbers returning disabled are higher than we had estimated. It's close to 50% now. And the cost per disabled, injured troop is higher. So we had talked to then about the cost of health care and disability payments for our returning troops in the order of magnitude, a little less than $500 billion. That's a lot of money. Our new numbers are, best estimate, in excess of $900 billion. These are unfunded liabilities, a moral obligation. They fought for us. Unfunded, totally unfunded. The good news is that we're trying to put together a coalition of people who believe in responsible budgeting. They say, okay, if we're going to send our troops overseas, we ought to at least put aside the money to pay for the full-in cost. The full-in cost include the cost of these disabled people.
So what you're estimating the cost of both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan now at?
Well, well in excess of the $3 trillion. Before, the numbers that we said were actually $3 to $5 trillion. That doesn't sound as catchy a title as the $3 to $5 trillion war. The numbers now are much more like $4 to $6 trillion. And
yet across this country, as the debates over, you know, for various congressional and Senate seats, for any seat, whether you're talking about a state one as well, war is almost never raised.
Yeah, I don't understand that, because what should be so clear is that we have a limited amount of resources. And the critics who say we have to worry about the debt are right in emphasizing the economics of scarcity, that we have a limited amount of resources. But the issue isn't whether to cut back. The issue is how we spend our money. Because cutting back would weaken the economy. But reallocating our money, more money for those who are unemployed. Remember, we have one of the worst systems of social protection, unemployment insurance of the advanced industrial countries. We are a whole group of people called the 99ers who have come to the end of their unemployment benefits and are being, you know, left to fend for themselves. So what we really need to do is to rethink how we spend the money, make sure that we spend money in a way that will energize our economy. Spending money in Afghanistan, paying money for contractors, are not the way to energize our economy and make our economy strong, competitive for the long run.
How much do you think a stimulus should be in this country?
Well, I think we really need $400-500 billion a year. And part of the reason why we should try to keep that those kinds of numbers in mind is to realize that we have a federal system. About a third of all spending is at the state and local level. And the states have balanced budget frameworks, which mean when the revenues go down, they have to cut back spending or raise taxes, which is very difficult in the current environment. And their revenues are going down. They depend very heavily on property taxes. Values of real estate have gone down 30-40%, in some places 50%. And the result of this is that we're laying off teachers. We're laying off those who provide basic services. So while the government is coming to the end, the federal government's coming to the end of the stimulus, the states are retracting. We saw that in the September numbers on jobs. 67,000 private sector jobs were created, not enough for the new entrants in the labor force, so less than half the amount we needed. But we lost, in total, 95,000 jobs. In other words, there was about 140,000 loss in the public sector, predictable. I talk about that in my book, predictable. unless we find some ways of making up for their shortfall.
And you say the stimulus would do that.
If we have another stimulus, it could do that.
So why don't you think President says that, even in his own interest? I mean, when you see the Democrats caving, falling all over the country, what looks like the predictions for this election?
I said that that's what we should have done in the first round of stimulus, because it was so clear where we were going.
So who's not listening to you? President Obama, Timothy Geithner, Larry Summers now gone.
I think, let me be frank, I think what happened is that some of these people who helped create the crisis, who, were in favor of the deregulation, who didn't do their job regulating the banks that they should have done.
Naming names here.
Well, you can figure out who
are. No, you tell us.
Well, Geithner was the head of the New York Federal Reserve Board, whose responsibility is overseeing New York banks.
Now the Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner.
And we know Larry Summers was, his great achievement was passing the law that deregulated, make sure that derivatives, these risky securities that led to the downfall of AIG costing $180 billion, his great achievement was to make sure that this was not regulated. Not regulated as a gambling product, not regulated as an insurance product, not regulated as securities. Well, having created these problems, they had an incentive, quite frankly, to try to say this is, the problems are not that deep. All we have to do is fix the banking system. There's been an accident. Who could have predicted this? And the answer is a lot of us did. But it was something that happened to the banking system rather than something the banking system did to us. So their incentive, this is a problem of accountability, their incentive was to try to say, okay, we've had an accident. We put the banks into the hospital. We give them a little money. Let's not try to interfere how they spend the money, because that's not the way we do things. So that they could take that money rather than recapitalize, give it out in bonuses or dividends. But we just put it in the hospital for a couple years. And meanwhile, we have this moderate size stimulus. But then year and a half later, 2 years later, the banks have recovered, and we go back to where we were before 2007. Well, reality is that the economy was sick before that, and you can't go back to 2007. And now we're at the end of the 2 years. It's so clear that the economy is not back to health, and that 2-year stimulus was too small, not well enough designed, and we're left in the situation that we have today, where the economy clearly continues to be sick, not in the sense that the banks are making profits again, Wall Street is not doing badly, but sick in the real sense. 1 out of 6 Americans who would like a full-time job cannot get one. That is a sick economy, in my mind.
Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, his book Free Fall is just out in paperback, subtitled America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. So let's go to the world economy. There have been a wave of protests across Europe against the so-called austerity measures and budget cuts in several European countries. In France, workers are striking for the 7th straight day over pension reform. In Britain, the government's preparing to reveal the biggest program of budget cuts in decades. Unions held a rally in London Tuesday to protest the cuts.
These cuts will lose over 1 million jobs. And let's be clear, this is not an economic necessity, but a political choice that they're making.
It's absolutely crucial at the moment that we don't allow our public sector to be assassinated and decimated, not just because public services will be affected, but because the whole of our country's economy will be maybe leading for a double dip. Recession. We may not recover for many years to come.
That's Britain. Your response, Joe Stiglitz.
I'm terribly worried, not just for Britain, but for the world economy. It was a moment after Lehman Brothers fell, the world came together. We were all Keynesians. That is to say, we all knew that what the economy needed was each country had to stimulate their economy. that moment of global consensus is gone. And what is going on now is in a very large number of countries that we're going back to what I call Hooverite policies. I mean, we've tried this experiment where you have conservatives say, okay, the deficit has gone up, and if we're going to restore confidence, we have to bring down the deficit by cutting back spending. This is an experiment we've tried over and over again. After the stock market crashed, Hoover succeeded in bringing us into the Great Depression by exactly that kind of reasoning. What happens is, interesting, it's self-defeating. Because the economy gets weaker, the deficit, tax revenues go down, the deficit doesn't get that much better. But meanwhile, because the spending goes down, the economy, jobs get destroyed, economy gets weaker and weaker, confidence gets destroyed, not restored. Because we live in a globally integrated economy, what happens in Europe will affect us. President Obama, many other leaders would have hoped that one of the ways that the U.S. economy would be restored would be through exports. But if Europe is weak, we're not going to be able to export.
This is a question we just got submitted to our Facebook page from Stevie Hawkins in Atlanta, Georgia. Some people on the right are labeling the French uprising as the dangers of socialism. What would you say to them?
No, what they're asking is we need social protection. Workers individually can't control the economic environment. You know, in the old economy, agriculture economy, you could work your field. You were still buffeted by vagaries in weather, international prices, but you could always get a job because you could work your own field. But in a modern economy, if firms are firing, you have no choice. You know, there are very limited opportunities that the individual has. So it is the responsibility of the state, of the government, to maintain the economy at full employment. And we recognize that in the Full Employment Act of 1946. Unfortunately, we are not living up to the commitment we made in 1946 to maintain the economy at full employment. We have, as I said, one out of six workers who are unemployed. Increasingly, a large number are unemployed now for over 6 months.
Joe Stiglitz, we just have time for one question, last question, which is about China raising its interest rates for the first time in nearly 3 years, coming a day after the Treasury Secretary vowed not to devalue the dollar to boost the economy. Explain the significance of this.
Well, the one source of strength in the global economy has been the emerging markets. And they've been doing very, very well. The problem is that the Federal Reserve has been letting forth a flood of liquidity in the hope that it would reignite the American economy. But the administration and Federal Reserve did not fix the banking system, did not deal with the mortgage problem that we were talking about before. So the money isn't going into the American economy. Lending is actually below what it was in 2007. In a globalized economy, the money is looking for the best place to go. And where is it finding it? In the emerging markets. So the irony is that money that was intended to rekindle the American economy is causing havoc all over the world. Those elsewhere in the world say what the United States is trying to do is the 21st century version of beggar-than-neighbor policies that were part of the Great Depression. You strengthen yourself by hurting the others. You can't do protectionism in the old version of raising tariffs, but what you can do is lower your exchange rate. And that's what low interest rates are trying to do, weaken the dollar. The flood of liquidity abroad is trying to push the exchange rates abroad. And they're saying, we can't allow that.
And 30 seconds, China in particular?
Well, in the case of China in particular, if it slows down significantly, it's going to be bad for the U.S. economy, not just directly, but China has been the support for Latin America, Africa. China's become the real engine of global economic growth. If it slows, Africa, Latin America slows, and that means American markets all over the world are going to have difficulties.
We're going to leave it there. Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, his book Free Fall is just out in paperback, America, Free Markets and the Sinking of the World Economy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, NAACP has a new report out called Tea Party Nationalism. Stay with us.
Today, the color line is the power line, is the poverty line.
Line by Asian Dub Foundation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Less than 2 weeks before the midterm elections, the NAACP has published a new report that exposes what it calls links between various Tea Party organizations and racist hate groups here in the U.S. The 94-page report was written by the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. It analyzes each of the six most active Tea Party organizations in the country and describes links between Tea Party factions and various white supremacist groups, anti-immigrant organizations, and militias. The report says, quote, Tea Party organizations have given platforms to anti-Semites, racists, and bigots. Further, hardcore white nationalists have been attracted to these protests, looking for potential recruits and hoping to push these white protesters toward more self-conscious and ideological white supremacy. In July, the NAACP created a firestorm when the group's delegates passed a resolution at their national convention condemning racism within the Tea Party movement. The NAACP Board of Directors ratified the resolution last week. The new report being released today is called Tea Party Nationalism, a critical examination of the Tea Party movement and the size, scope, and focus of its national factions. Ben Jealous is the president and CEO of the NAACP. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. And we're also joined by Leonard Zuskin, president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights and one of the authors of the report. He's also author of the book Blood and Politics, The History of White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ben Jealous, let's start with you. Lay out the scope of this report. These are very incendiary charges, especially right before the midterm elections.
We are—this report is here to affirm basic values of civility in this country. This report shouldn't be controversial. What we're saying is that there's no room in the politics of this country, in the discourse in our great town square, for people to stand up and spew racism and xenophobia and call for violence towards minority groups. We have never called the Tea Party racist. We're not attacking the Tea Party. We're simply asking them to continue to deal responsibly with the racists and the ranks, as they've started to in a very small way. You know, this summer we put a small light on them with that resolution, and they responded by throwing out Mark Williams, who had for months had made very racist comments. But after that call, about a week after, they threw him out. Then they followed up with Mr. Ravindal, who appeared on his Facebook page to call for death to gay people, and they threw him out as leader of Big Sky Tea Party, and we're saying, good, those are good first steps. Keep on going. You've got a clean house. If you do so, you won't just make this country better. You'll make your own Tea Party better.
Leonard Zuskin, with the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, talk about the six groups that you analyzed.
We looked first at the core of the movement, which includes Tea Party Express, which is a PAC and doesn't have any membership on the ground, although it has significant contributors that they float money to candidates with. The next one is probably the best. The next one in size is 1776 Tea Party. That was actually started by Minuteman Vigilante Group. Well, not started, but is now led by people who were the executive director and media director of the Minuteman Project Vigilante Group. So the 1776 Tea Party is basically a recreation of the Minutemen, for all intents and purposes. The next one in size, actually the second from the smallest, is the one that everybody knows, which is Freedom Works Tea Party, headquartered here in the D.C. area. Chair is Dick Armey and is well-known and quoted often in the media, but does not have much of a real following. There's Tea Party Nation, which was headquartered in Tennessee, and they're the ones that had the convention earlier in the year with Sarah Palin, and they've got something of a membership. The next one in terms of size, which is probably twice as big as Tea Party Nation and 2.5 times the size of Freedom Works, is ResistNet Tea Party. That's a more loosely structured Tea Party. That's where we found a lot of the racists. That's where we found a lot of the nativists and anti-immigrant and xenophobes. And also Tea Party Patriots is bigger even than ResistNet. It's the biggest of the six national factions. It's the most decentralized. In the state of Missouri, where I'm from, where the Tea Parties are recruiting at gun shows, it's the Tea Party Patriots that have most of the actual chapters on the ground.
And where does white supremacy come into this?
Well, what you see is at several points. You see white nationalists moving into the Tea Parties. We've talked about that since the July meeting. We found people from the Stormfront website. We found people from the Council of Conservative Citizens in the Tea Parties. We found a board member of the council leading a Tea Party in Florida. So we know that the councils are actually in the leadership of the Tea Party in some local areas. We've also found that there's just generic racism of the everyday unconscious sort with the flying of the Confederate battle flags. You'll note, if you go to our website, teapartynationalism.com, where the report is, we've got pictures from the various Tea Party events. One of them is with a Confederate battle flag. Well, this is not from Alabama or Mississippi. This is a Confederate battle flag flown at a Tea Party event in the state of Washington, not part of the Confederacy. It's a sign of white resistance. So we see these kinds of signs and symbols. And then when we looked at the actual talk of these Tea Parties amongst themselves, for example, we found a number of them where they're fearful of, you know, the demographic transformation of our democracy, as if that's going to have something to do with one person, one vote. We see an assault on the 14th Amendment coming from the Tea Parties. We know that the Tea Party caucus in Congress, which is 51 congressmen, Congress representatives led by Michelle Bachmann, 39 of them, 76% of that caucus is supporting a bill that's sitting in the House of Representatives that is aimed at ending birthright citizenship. Well, birthright citizenship is part of the 14th Amendment. You cannot claim that you're for the Constitution of the United States, as all these Tea Partiers do, and also say that you're for ending birthright citizenship and therefore eviscerating the 14th Amendment. You cannot claim that you're part of the Constitution and want to get rid of the 17th Amendment, which is the direct election of U.S. senators. And there's workshops at Tea Party Patriots Convention last May in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, where they're holding workshops on how to get rid of the 17th Amendment. And that's not a widespread phenomenon, but it's enough for us to talk about and note that these people that claim that they're for the Constitution are actually trying to get rid of some of the central democratic features in the Constitution.
One of the very close races in the country is in Colorado, the Senate race between Democrat Michael Bennett and the Tea Party favorite Republican Ken Buck. They were on Meet the Press on NBC, and Ken Buck was asked by host David Gregory about the NAACP report.
There are some serious charges that I want you to respond to. The result of this study contravenes many of the Tea Party's self-invented myths, particularly their supposedly sole concentration on budget deficits, taxes, and the power of the federal government. Instead, this report found a Tea Party ranks to be permeated with concerns about race and national identity and their so-called social issues. Tea Party organizations have given platforms to anti-Semites, racists, and bigots. Further, hardcore white nationalists have been attracted to these protests, looking for potential recruits and hoping to push these white protesters toward a more self-conscious and ideological white supremacy. If you're senator, do you think these elements in the Tea Party need to be dealt with and need to be rebuffed?
Absolutely. First of all, I haven't seen it. I've been to over 800 events in Colorado in the last 20 months. I have not seen that. And I find it offensive that folks would try to label the Tea Party in that way. It's just not true in Colorado. I don't know if it's true in other states. I haven't been to the other states. But I can tell you that if there are people that hold those views, they are quickly asked to leave meetings. I have not seen them in meetings.
Senator.
That's Republican Colorado Senate candidate Ken Buck on Meet the Press. Ben Jealous, your response.
Sure. You know, the whole point of this report is so that people can't say that they don't know. You know, we saw that same sort of response this summer. It was the first response when we released our resolution calling for them to repudiate racists in their ranks was to deny. Then they lied and said that we called them racist, which we haven't called the Tea Party racist. We just said, look, you've got some racist groups in here. You've got some racist leaders in here. You have to deal with them. And then within days, they threw out Mark Williams for making racist comments. That's why you shine a light, because when things are kept in darkness, people often don't see what's right in front of them. And so we're putting this big light. We're laying out the facts. We're showing the links so people can't keep their head in the sand and say, I don't see it. I don't see it. Get your head out of the sand, come into the light. Here's the report. Now you know. Do something about it.
What do you want them to do? And what would you say to those like Ken Buck who say, you know, I would decry anyone who comes to these groups, the idea of who they attract? Are they responsible for this?
Well, first of all, we would say thank you. You know, just like we said thank you when Tea Party Federation kicked out Mark Williams and when Big Sky Tea Patriots kicked out Mr. Ravindal a few weeks later and when Tea Party Nation issued a statement condemning racism. We're even glad to see Dick Armey, you know, come out there and try to push more black speakers at Tea Party events. All of those are good signs. We're not in this to attack the Tea Party. We're in this to stand up for basic values of inclusion, basic values of civil discourse. We're in this because we've seen in too many Tea Party events, like there's ones in Florida where the actual factions are led by members of the Council of Conservative Citizens, the lineal descendant of the White Citizens Council. The Council of Conservative Citizens says that black people are not genetically equipped for democracy, and there simply should be no way for one of their board members to affiliate themselves as a leader in the Tea Party, as happened there, as has happened in Missouri. We want the Tea Party, again, quite frankly, to create a better Tea Party, help us create a better country by continuing to affirm those leaders who have stood up to people like Mark Williams and to keep going further, because there are many other Mark Williams in leadership posts throughout this country in the Tea Party.
Leonard Zeskin, we only have 30 seconds. What were you most surprised by in the research you did for this report?
I was surprised that 5 out of the 6 national Tea Party factions had people in leadership positions or gave voice to the people that said that President Obama is not a natural-born American. The fact that these birthers are in the leadership of these Tea Parties, including the Tea Party Nation, the fact that Mr. Buck missed the rhetoric of Tom Tancredo, who bashes immigrants all the time, and he doesn't think that is racist, that's a problem.
We're going to have to leave it there. Leonard Zeskind and Ben Jealous, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our report. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire for The Caduce. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.